Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and I'm laughing in anticipation for the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Aloha, Chris Jericho. Aloha, everybody there. It's Duff McKagan calling, and I just wanted to say, you know, I keep a guitar in my car now. Yeah, it's good for traffic jams. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Still laughing. A good one from rock and roll legend and Hall of Famer Duff McKagan, enjoying some well-deserved R&R with his family in beautiful Hawaii after that monster Guns N' Roses world tour. I'm sure they'll be going out again soon. But today on the show, Dave Meltzer is back now to talk about the late Ole Anderson. Ole passed away last week at the age of 81. A true character in the business, left an incredible mark in the pro wrestling business as both a booker and a performer. Even if he didn't necessarily make a lot of friends, I never met Ole, but Dave did, and we actually talk a little bit about his infamous interview with Mr. Anderson, cantankerous, to say the least. We also talk about Ole's start in the business, how he became an Anderson and got teamed up with Gene Anderson in 1968 as the Minnesota Wrecking Crew. We get into his time as booker of Jim Barnett's Georgia Championship Wrestling, my boy, and how Ole eventually got Jim kicked out of the promotion, almost charged him with embezzlement, and then finally took over as the owner of GCW. You hear the story about the Briscoes and Vince McMahon's surprise purchase and takeover of Georgia Championship Wrestling, the infamous Black Saturday, and how they were able to keep it a secret from Ole, which is so insane in this day and age to think about that. We talk about Ole's run as booker at WCW and his relationship with Eric Bischoff. We talk about his reputation as a divisive figure in this business. And of course, we talk about the formation of the Four Horsemen. It's a look at Ole Anderson's contributions to wrestling, both good and bad, right here, right now on Talk is Jericho.
Well, and it's interesting. So Ole Anderson, there's a few guys in my career that I never met. And believe it or not, being as many places as I have, I never met Vader.
Really?
Never. And I never met Ole.
Wow.
Oh, obviously, the one Ole story that I have by proxy was Benoit told me that the first time he went to WCW, remember he was there earlier, like I think in 94 or something?
He had that short run.
Yeah. I guess Ole was the booker at the time or something like that, or was there and came up to him and said, "Who the fuck are you?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm Chris Benoit." He goes, "Are you a wrestler?" He goes, yeah, I work here. He goes, "Wow, are you ever ugly?"
Ugh. Oh, God.
So that kind of
story
set the tone for Ole. But talk about how you mentioned he was a big player at the time and kind of give a little bit of background on him, because you have a lot of interesting stories about him just from listening the last couple of days and reading your piece that you wrote about him.
Yeah, I mean, Ole, you know, I mean, he started out as a wrestler with Vern Gagne broke him in, and there was like a very famous story about him. Ole came out of college and out of the military. He had this big chest and big arms for the time. You know what I mean? This big, thick guy. And the Bruiser and the Crusher were like that, and they were getting up in years, which is funny because this is like 65, and they both probably went 15 more years. But at the time, they were, you know, old. They were considered getting old. And so it was kind of like, hey, we got another big, thick guy like the Bruiser and the Crusher.
Yeah.
But they still put him through the ringer, you know, where they do the squats till you drop and then wrestle Danny Hodge, right? And I mean, you know, Danny Hodge put him in the hospital, and the story was, I guess Johnny Valentine was there, and Johnny Valentine – you know, and Ole's kind of mad. He's got a broken nose and some broken ribs, and his skin is all raw from being just rubbed in the ground by Danny Hodge. And he's kind of like, you know, why'd they do this to me? And Johnny Valentine goes, Danny Hodge liked you. It would have been much worse.
Ole said out of the three guys that they wanted him to train with or something, he said, I'll take the little guy.
Right.
And the little guy was Danny Hodge. And then just stretched him and stiffed him, like you mentioned.
Yeah. So the story was, it was Vern Gagne, Dale Lewis, and Danny Hodge. And he goes, which of the three do you want to wrestle? And the first guy he picks is, I'll take the little guy. No, that's Vern's story. Ole's story was always completely different. Ole always said that, I understand that makes a good story, but the reality is when I was in high school wrestling, we had pictures of Danny Hodge on our high school wrestling.
Right. Gotcha.
I knew who he was, but that still doesn't explain why you would have picked Danny Hodge. Because, yeah. So there is a little thing about, like, you know, what's the credibility of the story? So he went to the hospital and he didn't come back for a month, and he came back in a month. And the fact that he did come back, you know, Vern was very impressed. And, you know, then they trained him to wrestle because of his look. They pushed him from day one. I mean, he was like, you know, undercard guy, of course, but, you know, would win his prelims. And he was in a main event tag title match in Milwaukee like 2 months after he started. And then they sent him to Omaha where, you know, he was put over as like top big babyface Rock Rogowski. And like about a year later, he went to the Carolinas. You know, it's going to be his first. Well, Omaha is like a small territory. Carolina is a bigger territory. Mm. So it's his first territory out of the AWA. He arrives there and he knew Lars Anderson, Larry Hainemi from St. Cloud State College. They were, you know, wrestlers both at the school. And Lars was the better wrestler. Lars was actually a very good wrestler in college. So he shows up at the airport and the guy goes, and Lars goes to him and just goes, you're now Ole Anderson, and explains that Gene Anderson's a big star here and I'm a big star here and you're going to be our third man. So he became Ole Anderson and Lars ended up leaving. And so it was Gene and Ole for years and years and years in the Carolinas and Georgia, you know, one of the top heel tag teams for, you know, over a decade, really, just over a decade. At first, the Carolinas were not what I would call a major territory. Georgia, because of the wrestling war and Jim Barnett being in charge, was actually pretty major territory. And Ole ended up being booker there from like 76 on. And, you know, he booked himself very strong and for good reason. They did great business, you know, with Wrestling One and Wrestling Two, mm-hmm. all the different baby faces that were there, and probably peaked when 79 feud with Dusty Rhodes, who was the baby face of that era. And, you know, Ole was booker. Ole ended up being general manager of the promotion. Then they sold the promotion out from under him. He started his own promotion, that lasted about a year. Then he was with Crockett as a wrestler. And then after wrestling, he was with WCW and at times booked WCW. At times he ran the training center and then eventually was fired. And, you know, I mean, that was his run. I mean, Ole was really one of the best promo guys I've ever seen, especially from a heel standpoint. If you watch his promos, I just remember as a little kid, it was like he was so easy to hate, you know, because he was just
right.
And the dichotomy with Dusty. Dusty was so good working off of him. And, you know, they both took credit. You know, I mean, like, I know people who don't like Ole go, oh, you know, anyone would have worked and drawn with Dusty was the biggest draw. But, you know, aside from Terry Funk and Ric Flair, you know, Ole may have been Dusty's best opponent, one of them. But in Georgia, you know, it was a legendary feud. And I just remember Ole had this manner of doing heel promos where he looked into the camera and he was just a menacing guy, you know, like you very, very believable, mm-hmm. no entertainment whatsoever about him, no frivolity, just a mean, kind of big, thick, mean guy that, you know, you really want to see get his ass kicked. And you knew that, you know, unless it was a main event level guy like Dusty or Wahoo or whatever, you know, it ain't going to work. Ole's too tough. And that's why, you know, I mean, Ole drew very well for, you know, a long period of time, really.
It's interesting, back in those days, in the late 70s, early 80s, most of the wrestlers in general, especially the heels, were all, like you said, big, beefy, boxy guys.
Yeah.
I know Crusher and Ray Stevens weren't heels per se, but that look, like you mentioned, with the Andersons and those types of guys, even a guy like Nick Bockwinkel, he was in shape, but they were just bigger guys pre the steroid boom. So you would see a guy like Ole and go, he looks like a barroom brawler, and that kind of intimidated you. Harley was like that too, obviously.
Yeah. They were kind of cut from that mold, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just big guys that obviously lifted heavy weights. They didn't look like bodybuilders or anything like that, but they were just big, thick guys. And you got to remember also, back in that era, you know, really people's concept about what a fighter was completely different. It was always about guys with big muscles, not necessarily pretty muscles, but big, thick shoulders and big arms and things like that. Because we never, I mean, yeah, we had boxing, but, you know, we didn't have MMA where you would see guys that it's really not your look, it's really your skill. You know, back then it was just like who looked mean and in wrestling, even more important, looked mean, but also was the ability to talk mean. And that's where Ole was the best or one of the best was that, you know, he was like Harley Race. You know, you looked at him and he was direct and they were tough guys and they believed what they said and they could convince you. That was the key to their success is being that and being a threat to your baby face and also just wanting to see them get their ass kicked. And, you know, your top baby face was the guy for the job.
So Gene and Ole were the Minnesota Wrecking Crew, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Wrecking Crew first. So when you mentioned they kind of in the 70s, who were their biggest rivals and who were kind of their best matches against? You mentioned Dusty. Was Dusty in a team at the time? Where was that at?
Dusty would do revolving partners. This is in Georgia. But like
Georgia.
In the Carolinas, you know, I mean, it started with like Johnny Weaver and George Becker and then, you know, the Scott brothers, George and Sandy Scott. And the guys they drew the best with was probably Wahoo McDaniel and Paul Jones because they were, you know, it was like they were very good with tough style guys. The biggest drawing team ever against the Andersons was Ric Flair and Greg Valentine when it was the Battle of the Heels.
Oh, wow.
And the fans were completely behind Flair and Valentine in this feud. You know, the thing is, Ric Flair was brought to the Carolinas. You know, he was an unknown, you know, I mean, Wahoo brought him in. He was a prelim guy in Minnesota.
Right.
Kind of like this, you know, George Scott kind of saw him as a Buddy Rogers type nature boy. But to give him credibility, because the Andersons had been around and they'd always done a thing in the Carolinas where somehow, I don't know why Minnesota was the heels. You know what I mean? You know, like culturally, like being from Minnesota, being a northerner, I guess, worked in the Carolinas. So Ric Flair, you know, who was from the Minneapolis area and was brought in from Minneapolis as the cousin of the Andersons. So when Ric came in, he already was accepted as like, well, he must be a guy we have to reckon with because he's the cousin. And so they would do the six-man tags. I mean, he wasn't really associated with them for very long. Ric had his own path, but it was always Ric Flair, the cousin of the Andersons. I mean, even when I first started watching Georgia wrestling and Ric would come in as a big special attraction, so this is 78, 79, 80, it was always mentioned in passing, you know, he's cousins with the Andersons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Even when he like kind of outgrew it. And so in the Carolinas, they always referred to him as that. And then when they would do the feud, you know, it was the cousin thing. And that was the biggest one, you know, was Ric Flair and in the Carolinas. And then in Georgia, it was really, you know, their big feud was Mr. Wrestling and Mr. Wrestling 2 because the two mask guys.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Where did Arn come in with them as an Anderson? Because once again, to you, all three of these guys look very similar and they're not even close to being family.
So that's the funny one because, so Arn Anderson, of course, is Marty Lundy.
Yeah.
And he just started wrestling as Marty Lundy. I think he went to work for Watts very early in his career. He looked so much like Ole. I mean, it was never true. And I don't know, but people would, wrestling fans would absolutely say it, you know, that, oh yeah, you know, because he was from Macon, Georgia and Ole worked, you know, every week in Macon, Georgia for, you know, for years on end. And then you go back to the Carolinas and all that. So it was almost like this thing of like, wait a minute, is he really Ole's son? Right. Because he looked just like him. And then they did the thing. Obviously Ole didn't want the idea of a son to age him. He was either the cousin or the nephew, depending on, you know, Ole accepting that he was the older one as the nephew. But he wanted him to be the cousin, you know?
Right.
So it was because of the look. And then they changed his name to Arn Anderson. And then later, you know, he'd been Arn Anderson for a while. And when Ole was really not wrestling a lot. And then when Ole came back to wrestle, you know, they made them the new Minnesota Wrecking Crew. Gene was long gone by this point. It gave Arn more credibility as a star to be part of that Anderson dynasty.
When did Ole start getting involved behind the scenes? Because I think probably his behind the scenes career is as great, if not greater, than his in-ring career.
I mean, it's more noteworthy in a lot of ways politically. I mean, even though he was a big star, you know, because of so many of the stories that happened, Georgia was such a crazy place because what happened was there was a big wrestling war in 72 in Georgia. And this is before Ole is actually really part of the scene. And it was there was the established NWA promotion. And Ray Gunkel was the guy running the company, basically. And Buddy Fuller, you know, who's Ron Fuller's father and things like that. There were all these different people, but Ray Gunkel was running it. And then Ray Gunkel dies of a heart attack. And his widow, Ann Gunkel, kind of a beauty queen and everything, who was close with Ted Turner and had a lot of connections from whatever, you know, modeling. You know, she was a model and everything. So the old boys, you know, basically tried to get rid of her because Ray's gone. Well, you know, what happens is that Ann, because the wrestlers were all very loyal to Ray, Ann started a promotion on Thanksgiving. It was roughly Thanksgiving week. And Thanksgiving was the biggest night of the year for Atlanta wrestling going back forever. Mm-hmm. So on the morning of the Thanksgiving show in 1972, there's a big front page lead story in the newspaper on wrestling. Everyone from Georgia Championship Wrestling has quit to form a new promotion with Ann Gunkel. And then they had to do a show that night. So what happened was Eddie Graham was kind of like the catalyst of all this. And he just found all these guys that had the night off or were going to skip a booking just so they could do this big show in Atlanta that night and then start building from there to rebuild the company. Because aside from Bob Armstrong, who stayed, and a guy named Daryl Cochran, and I think maybe one of the refs, everybody else left. So that was the thing. So Barnett was brought in to run Georgia. And they ended up running Ann out of business by about 74. And they were on TBS, which was just, you know, local Channel 17, no big deal.
Right.
And then in 76, Ted Turner, who's the owner of Channel 17, decides to put this thing on satellite, you know, and everyone's just laughing at why would anyone in Columbus, Ohio, watch this Georgia champion, you know, not the wrestling, but a local Channel 17, right? It's like,
right.
And the funny part is we got this here in California in the early days. And I mean, it was all commercials for like a suit company or a pickup store or, you know what I mean? All these things in the greater Atlanta area. And we're watching these commercials. It's almost like you're transplanted to another world. Like you're watching something you're not supposed to be seeing unless you're living in Atlanta. You're watching this local UHF station, but we're watching it here. And of course I watch it constantly because it had the Braves and the soccer team and the wrestling more than anything. So by this point in 76, this is right around the time actually that they go first up on the satellite and they're starting to be seen in other parts of the country. You know, the real growth was 76, but I think it really got strong around 78. And Ole was the booker at this point. He was made booker by Jim Barnett. Considered had a good booking mind and was very successful at it. You know, he knew how to book. He learned from George Scott, and he was an intelligent guy. And it was one of those things, you know, when you look back on it, and I mean, you and I couldn't, like, because we've seen it so much, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we've seen so many of these guys where they'll have a run 3 or 4 years and it's successful as hell. You know, they got it. And then they just tried that same formula. And Ole would even say, like, human psychology doesn't change. It's always the same. But the reality is like, it does change, you know? And it's like, and fans change, you know, like the fans that you're performing for now are completely different from the fans you performed for even 15 years ago, let alone, you know, whatever. The fans evolved, they changed, and Ole knew one formula. It worked until it stopped working. He didn't evolve. He kept trying to do the same formula over and over and over again. And then the weirdest part, you know, with Ole's booking, somebody brought this up to me last night and just goes, Ole came up with this Black Scorpion thing. It's like, did that come from Jim Herd? Because it's like, that's so unlike Ole. And I don't know the answer. It's like when Sting first won the title, you know, Ole had this idea that he was this mystery man from his past. The Black Scorpion was going to be his rival. I mean, it did draw one good TV rating, but it really hurt Sting's first run.
Let's explain that a little bit. So the Black Scorpion, and then talk about how he was presented and kind of what the character was.
Yeah. So Sting, they had built for a while to build up Sting beating Ric Flair, and Sting was going to be the franchise of WCW, and kind of was for on and off, you know, especially before Hogan came. But Sting was going to be the big star. Instead of getting Sting and Ric Flair was always going to be all right, but you couldn't do it forever. And so they had to build up a new opponent. And so Ole came up with this mysterious Black Scorpion. And who is this guy? And blah, blah, blah. He's a guy from Sting's past. They built to a TV show where, you know, you thought that you'd probably find out who the guy was. And I think it ended up being Al Perez. And from that point, then it was less like, this isn't the real Black Scorpion. There's a real Black Scorpion. This was a fake one. And at that point, it kind of ran the, you know, it was like, there was no Black Scorpion. The Black Scorpion was some guy in every house show. It's just some guy, Bill Irwin or Dave Sheldon. And people, you know, were smart enough then to know that, like, Sting's defending his title against these non-entities. And it really hurt him, you know. And you know,
that's so crazy too, because I remember, like, he had some kind of a gimmick voice, like some kind of electronic.
It was Ole's voice,
right? Distorted though, right?
It was Ole's voice distorted, yeah, because we could tell by the Ole cadence. But yeah, the voice was completely distorted, and it's Sting. And I mean, and Sting had to sell this hocus pocus stuff, which I think that the crowd was way beyond that at that point.
It's so weird though. You're putting Sting, who at the time was fairly green, correct?
I mean, he'd been, 4 years in or so, yeah.
Okay, but that's pretty green in the big picture. So he's working with Flair, obviously one of the best in the world, or the best in the world. And then he's in there with the Black Scorpion mission. Al Perez, Dave Sheldon, Bill Irwin. These are not great workers. I mean, you know, they're pretty much mid-card, mid-level guys.
Right, right.
Working with Sting in the main events. I mean, that's... It almost seems like something that was done on purpose to sandbag Sting or something.
I mean, when you look back on it, I mean, and your point is, you know, think about this, because this is, again, I was living through this thing. Ric Flair had been champion or challenger for the title, you know, from 81, and this is 1990, so 9 years of these Ric Flair matches on top. Wow. You know how Ric was. I mean, Ric,
yeah.
You know, it could be in Greenville, South Carolina on a Friday night, and it's the same match that you're going to get in you know, at the Omni. I mean, Rick was just Rick. He was a machine. You always had that match. And when you paid to see Ric Flair and the world title, and Race was the same way. I mean, you really got like a great, great match. And then Sting is here as world champion. And it was going to be hard anyway for Sting, because even though Sting had incredible charisma, you know, he wasn't the worker Rick was as far as making a great match. And he also wasn't the promo guy Rick was. Although I do think Sting developed into a great promo guy later. But at the time, he was still kind of new at the promo game. And you're used to Ric Flair promos or Dusty Rhodes promos in your main event. Mm-hmm. And the Ric Flair match, you know, this 25-minute classic match where whatever. And instead, it's like Sting is working with Bill Irwin. And it feels like, you know, a mid-card match for 12 minutes. And that's your main event. And it was just a very different feel when you left the show than you had for all those years with Flair on top. So it was tough. Sting was absolutely put in a horrible position. I mean, they really should have had somebody who was a great, you know, a series of veteran heels that were good talkers that he could play off of. And there were guys that were around then, but Ole decided to do the mystery thing, which, like I said, it did work on TV. They did one great TV rating with it. But when you went month after month at the house shows with it, it was not successful.
It's so strange as a booker because, you know, even in AEW right now, you're setting up the challengers before there's even a title switch. And WWE does it. Obviously, that's what booking wrestling is. Japan does it too. It seems so strange to me that Ole wouldn't have had somebody in the wings waiting to challenge Sting as soon as he won the title that could work with him.
Yeah. I really don't have a good answer as to why. The one thing with the Black Scorpion that was intriguing at first was, it's like, it was said like a guy from his past, okay?
Right.
So everybody wanted it to be Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah.
Because they knew about the past, except Ultimate Warrior was the champion in WWE. So it's like you're doing this thing and people are, they know it's not Ultimate Warrior. And then some people thought, you know, maybe he's going to bring back Paul Orndorff, who was a big, big star. But it was like Ole really had no idea where this was going. There was never like, who's the ultimate destination? I mean,
right.
I first heard like, who's going to be the Black Scorpion, I was told Al Perez, which was the guy who it was on the first show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, okay, you know, once the people find out it's Al Perez, you know, you're almost going to feel like, you need to get that guy and you need to unmask that guy. And it needed to be, I mean, I don't know, Dick Murdoch or better. You know what I mean? It had to be somebody. Like,
somebody, yeah.
Yeah, somebody with.
Why wouldn't they have just had, you mentioned Al Perez, why wouldn't they just have kept Al Perez as the Black Scorpion, so at least they could get some kind of synergy and maybe work out some kind of a match that they could do every night? Or Dave, why'd they change it?
the Black Scorpion was just whoever was available that night. And that's how much care they took. You know what I mean?
Jeez, man. Isn't that crazy when you think about it?
Yeah, yeah. And this is the main event on all these house shows in a company where, you know, this was when house shows were your livelihood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like now where, you know, it's just about presentation of TV and pay-per-views. This was like, you know, and Ole came, that's the thing. And Ole came from the house show business.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't really like a pay-per-view guy. I mean, he learned a little bit about the pay-per-view was when he was booking and everything. And, you know, the TV that he would do, you know, I mean, he did TV, which was essentially squash matches and interviews.
Right.
It wasn't like now. And you know, you do a couple of angles where the, you know, heels beat up the babyface vows revenge Friday night at whatever, you know. I mean, that was though the only thing, which was whatever everyone did. He was good at it until, you know, things evolved. And I think that was the weakness also was that as more and more people became, you know, started watching what Vince did, because Vince had the better production values and was the major league and all that, the old stuff seemed kind of minor league-ish, except for the older fans that grew up on it that hated the Vince stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you're always trying to get a new audience. The new audience, like Vince and Hulk Hogan, it's like they were big-time celebrities. So your local wrestling was, you know, it couldn't keep up. It wasn't as impressive unless you're someone who just came in with, I don't like New York wrestling. And there was enough of that, but not enough to flourish.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Let's talk about the circumstances leading up to Black Saturday. We talk about that actually on Dark Side of the Ring this season. There's an episode about that.
Right.
But let's talk about that whole circumstance. It's still one of the crazier stories in wrestling history about how that all went down.
Yeah, it's really crazy. So, I mean, I guess the start of the story is that Ole's the booker for Jim Barnett. And Atlanta was a profitable company until it wasn't. So what happened was that Barnett as booker wanted Ole to have a financial stake. So basically Barnett maneuvered and said, you know, ask Bill Watts to own 10%, sell your 10% to Ole because Ole's going to be here and whatever. So they made a deal and Ole got 10% of the company. So now Ole has access to the books because he's an owner. And for Ole, it's like he's getting paid his booker, he's getting paid his main event talent, and then he's got an ownership cut. Okay. So he's really studying this as a businessman. And he sees that the company's losing lots of money. They were at $1,300,000 in the hole, which I know doesn't sound great now, but if you talk about 1980, that was a lot of money in 1980, right? Or 81, 82.
Sure.
And there were reasons, and it was Atlanta was losing money. They were booking the Omni every week because it was the idea was a weekly city. And the break even was, you know, you had to drop $5,000 a week to break even. And that was tough to do it week in and week out in that big building. And Barnett was a big spender too. So that was a lot of it too. So Ole investigates, he's looking through the books, and he sees that Barnett is a big spender, which, again, when the company's super profitable, nobody cares. We're all making money, right? When
right.
The company's losing money, and he sees $3,000 a month phone bills and private chef and private, you know, driver and penthouse apartment all charged to the company. It's just like Ole's just fuming, threatens to turn Barnett into the police for embezzlement. There's a big showdown. They want him out, and they got Ole and some of the other promoters, you know, when Ole's explaining it to the local promoters, they just wanted Barnett out. Barnett is both there for, you know, the thing, but he wanted to protect his reputation because he was a big arts guy. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
The idea is like, oh, you know, he's the president of this company that we all know that's on television. And so he just, can I keep my title? I'll even not take a salary. Can I keep my title? And it's just like, no, you're gone. Allegedly, at one point, Ole also threatens to beat him up if Barnett doesn't sign this thing. So Barnett agrees to it. Then he goes to his lawyer, you know, and it's like, oh, I signed it under duress. I don't want this. So anyway, it ends up Barnett's gone. Then next thing he does is he goes to work for Vince McMahon. Ole's running the company. So Ole did what he did was he stopped using big names and he ran more small shows and he got the company to where it had a $20,000 profit 1 year, but it was going nowhere. Like attendance dropped 60%, but he made it profitable by cutting out, you know, not booking big names.
Right.
So the Briscoes were, the Briscoes own 19.5% of the company. And they're looking at it as if there's no future. You know, it's like you keep cutting back and cutting back while Vince is on national TV with Hulk Hogan, right? And it's like you can only cut so much, but there's no future. There's no growth in this thing. The attendance is going down. And they're just looking for a way to, you know, make some money on their stock, which they thought was going to be their retirement, right? You know, we're just going to own 10% of this thriving company when we're 40 years old and it comes time to retire and it's get our dividends and it's all wonderful. And they realize that that's not happening. So Jack calls up Vince McMahon, and just basically sets the idea of like, you know, would you buy? And Vince is just like, I'm not buying unless you can get 50%, 51%.
51%, right.
51%. You know, I'll buy 51%. Other than that, no, I have no interest in buying this thing. So Barnett had sold to his college friend, Jim Oates. And then they also got Paul Jones, which is not the wrestler Paul Jones, but a old promoter. So between everyone, they had 67.5% of the stock. The key thing that was so crazy about this story is Ole is the general manager. He's running the company. And you also have Fred Ward and Ralph Fried, who ran Columbus and were also minority stockholders. Mm-hmm. But between the three of them, they own 32.5% of the company. So they have no idea any of this is going on. They're having, you know, Vince and the Briscoes got the signed proxy of Paul Jones. They got the agreement from Jim Oates. They kept it secret. And Vince even said, like, you know, if Ole finds out, this deal's done. You know, right, I mean? Yeah. So they had to all keep everything from Ole. So one day Ole wakes up and he finds out that the company sold to Vince McMahon. So Ole goes to court thinking, like, how can you sell this company when I never approved of it? And the Fried and Fred Ward didn't approve of it. And we own 32%. You know, it's like, it should be like all the owners should have to agree. So they had about a 3-month court fight, I think it was roughly, before eventually the court ruled in favor of Vince. And then that Saturday, you know, you turn on World Championship Wrestling on Channel 17, expecting to see Tommy Rich and Wrestling 2 and all your favorites. And there's Freddie Miller in an empty building with Vince McMahon and Gorilla Monsoon. And they're pitching to tapes from Boston and Philadelphia and just the same stuff that you would see on USA Network. So that's what, you know, that was how the sale ended up going down. And then even then, Ted Turner got so many complaints that he went and gave Ole a 7:30 a.m. time slot, which is not the on a Saturday, which is not the best time slot in the world. But Ole for a year still ran his, he started a new company, Championship Wrestling from Georgia. And, you know, they tried and everything. I mean, the one thing, Ole's biggest accomplishment, I would say, in that latter era when business was going down was the introduction of the Road Warriors.
Right, right. Well, before we get to World Warriors, let me just put a couple buttons on this other thing.
Okay.
Because what you wrote was when they got the 67%, that they were then wrote some kind of a codicil that said that the majority shareholders could then sell their stock without telling the minority shareholders. And that became law, right?
So see what happened. So this is with the meeting with Vince. So, yeah, because originally there was something in the, now Ole does have a different story, but this is the story that I'm going to tell is the one that came out in the court case. So I'm pretty sure it's the real story. You know, Ole's version was he had gone through the bylaws. He had seen that there was a hole, but the lawyers for Georgia Wrestling, and he complained about it because this may just be Ole trying to show, hey, I was all knowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I knew, but the lawyers told me, oh, this is never going to happen. There's nothing you need to worry about. Now, the way the court case went down was that they had the 67.5% of the voting share, but the papers, you know, for the company was that all owners needed to agree to a sale.
Right.
So what they did was they made an amendment, but to make amendments in that contract, you only needed 51%. So they first made an amendment to which allowed for the sale, and then 15 minutes later, you know, Vince bought it. So yeah, that's how it went down apparently.
Which is interesting too, because it just kind of as a parallel type of example, not to get too far into it, but it was like that in Winnipeg too, is we would get AWA, I'd say every 6 weeks or so. And then 1 week we showed up and it was not AWA, it was WWF. And here's Ted Arcidi and here's all these guys that you'd never seen before. But there was no warning. We just showed up and it was like, here's WWF. And you're like,
what's WWF? Same thing. He just was able to kind of steal the company away, I guess.
Well, what happened, I think in Winnipeg, it was Wally Carbo and Jack Lanz, I think, owned the rights to it. And they just, they went with Vince or sold to Vince or however it was. And Lanza got his job, you know, with Vince forever. You know, and Wally was, you know, Vern's right-hand man. So it was kind of like, you know, Vern never expected Wally to turn on him. But, and Lanza, you know, had worked for Vern, you know, going back to the 60s, most of his career, you know. So it was kind of like, I mean, not that, like, if you look at it in, you know, hindsight, especially Lanza, they made the right decision for them. Mm-hmm. But I think Vern would, you know, think that I employed these guys forever. And then all of a sudden they sell to Vince at a critical time in history. Yeah.
Was it a huge double cross for the Briscoes to go to Vince? Had they had any relationship working with Vince at all?
I mean, Jack wrestled, you know, in Madison Square Garden a couple of times. Mm-hmm. He was never full time in the territory and Jerry never worked there.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, Jack had a big, big name and everybody knew him, you know, I mean, it was like, he was a superstar.
Right.
When he called Vince up, it was kind of like, you know, I mean, it's Jack Briscoe, you know, he had a pretty big standing. But yes, as far as like to the wrestling fans, when they got the story, it was kind of like, you know, the wrestling fans are in the middle of their own war, right? You know, because, you know, they see WWF encroaching and it's infringing on in many of the territories. Like if you're Florida, Georgia, Carolinas, I mean, this is your wrestling that you grew up on. And you know from national TV, Vince is doing this and you didn't like his style because it was a different style for a lot of the fans. So then it was like, Jack Briscoe, who the NWA made world champion, went and sold to Vince. So it was like those double crossing Briscoes. You know, one thing I didn't write in the piece on Ole, but I remember this, and Animal has confirmed it. The Briscoes, you know, it told me the story. Jack had it in his book. But I remember when that happened, Ole calls up Jack. And it's basically the Road Warriors are going to go, I don't know, they're going to go to your house and they're going to beat you up. You know what I mean? Like that was like the old school mentality.
Yeah.
And I'm sending the Road Warriors after you guys. And, you know, Joe just said, look, you know, like, yeah, he did tell us this, but, you know, we're not going to do that. Right. And Jack had so much respect. You know what I mean? But I remember, you know, like Jack, you know, basically going like, yeah, we were kind of worried there for a week. And after a week, we had a big party because we knew they weren't coming. Because of the threat.
So talk about the Road Warriors. You mentioned that Ole, he put the Road Warriors together, discovered them, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, he had Joe Animal came in 82 and did a week or two of TV. And he was this big, thick guy who was just as green could be. I mean, it was his first matches. And he would just throw guys around, you know, take no care of them. I mean, it was pretty scary watching. And then they kind of calmed him down and Ole, he wasn't ready. So Ole sent him to work for Crockett. And Crockett, they were, you know, he worked in prelims for Crockett and made no money and just went home and just like, I'm done with this wrestling business.
Yeah.
And Hawk actually done the same thing in Vancouver. You know, he went there and made no money and came back and they were both bouncing at Grandma B's and that wrestling thing didn't work out, even though they had trained for it with Eddie Sharkey and everything. Ole had gone up there, you know, because he's a Minneapolis guy.
Right.
And he was friends with Eddie Sharkey. And it's just like, he's looking for new cheap talent, right, to replace the more expensive talent. So Eddie's showing him his giant bodybuilder dudes, you know, like it was those two and Rick Rude and Barry Darso. And Nikita came later, but he wasn't involved in that specific class. Eddie had a different idea of who would be the tag team. But Ole knew Joe, of course, from being there a year ago. So he's at the bar and he's talking to Hawk and he's talking about this and this and this, thinking it's Joe. And all of a sudden, you know, Hawk is like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never worked for you. And he looks at him and goes, oh my God, there's two of you. So he brought them in as the Road Warriors because the original Joe's first gimmick was just the Road Warrior. So he brought them both in as the Road Warriors tag team. And he promised him, he goes like, I'm giving you a push. You're going to make money. Oh, he built everything around them. And they were a hit.
Right.
The one thing with that Georgia was it was national TV. And even though the Georgia territory wasn't strong, you see these guys looking the way they did. You know, it was kind of similar to when Bill Goldberg started. You know, you just
didn't
really have guys like that. And they're winning these 2-minute matches. And they're working with you. Do you remember Mike Jackson, the little job guy?
I don't.
Okay. He was well before your time, but he was a great worker who was probably 165 pounds. Ole put him in there with those guys and they just looked like monsters next to this, you know, 5'7", 165 pound guy. And Mike was such a great bump taker. I mean, he made these guys look like, you know, they were the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I remember when I was working the first week when they showed up, I was working for a soccer team and we had a game that day. So I taped the Georgia wrestling, but I hadn't seen it. And one of my friends calls me, "You're never going to believe what I just saw." And he's just going like, "There are these guys." And it's like, they're Hulk Hogan, but they're cut because, you know, like, because yeah. next to Mike Jackson, they did look like they were, they're Hulk Hogan and they're cut. And they move like Tiger Mask. And it's like, because they did run around the ring a lot and Hawk did fly around a lot. You know, it's like, I never seen anything like them. And then I watched and it's like, yeah, they're green guys, but they were visually impressive and immediate hits, immediate hits.
Oh, did Ole build the territory around them at the time?
Yeah, I mean, he built around them. But the thing was, is the Road Warriors didn't make that much money for Ole. But what Ole would do is he would farm them out to Mid-South.
Ah, gotcha.
And Jarrett and all these places. And they would go in as, you know, Channel 17 or, you know, TBS superstars, the Road Warriors, against the local guys like Hacksaw Duggan and JYD or Jerry Lawler and Austin Idol, and they drew huge, or the Fabulous Ones. They would draw huge in these territories. So their outdates are, you know, and then eventually to Vern as well, their outdates were doing real well. So they were doing real well, but their base wasn't doing well. And eventually the inevitable was going to happen is they went full time with Vern because Ole didn't have the money to pay them like Vern did. And then eventually they went to Crockett because Vern didn't have the money to pay him like Crockett did. And that's why they ended up full time with Crockett.
Ole had a good eye for that talent, but there's other guys that Ole didn't see anything in that are some of the all-time greats.
I mean, the one story I'll always remember is Ole booked in the Carolinas in 81-ish, you know, for a while. And not that successfully. I think Dory Funk Jr. was next, and Dory Funk Jr. had some real big highs. Because everybody had their Ole stories.
Right.
And most were negative, but there were people who like, and older fans who also swore by him, you know what I mean? And you cannot take away he was very successful at a certain period of time for his booking. I mean, when I was a kid watching that Georgia wrestling, when Ole Anderson was feuding with Dusty Rhodes, it was fantastic. The promos were fantastic. The week to week, you know, I mean, it was a formula, you know, it was Dusty Rhodes and a partner.
Right.
And every week they would injure the partner and beat the partner, and Dusty come in with a new partner and a new partner. And then finally Dusty and, you know, whoever, Bill Watts or whatever, would get some wins. And but it was like a 4 month of big, big business. But anyway, so Ole didn't see Ricky Steamboat as a main event guy. I just remember it's like, and it's just like, he's the only one. And I was just thinking, like, the first time I ever saw Ricky Steamboat, which was actually Madison Square Garden, nobody knew who he was. It was Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood against Torquemada and Bulldog Brower, who were the worst opponents possible for fast guys. And they were freaking dynamic. I'd never seen anything like them. I mean, I'd never seen a babyface team that good, ever.
Right.
They were so quick and so good. And Ricky Steamboat, you know, look, he was like one of your heroes. You know Ricky Steamboat.
Absolutely.
But I mean, like the young Ricky Steamboat, I mean, he had what you saw in him, but he had that young 27-year-old, 26-year-old, 25, whatever he was. So he was born 52. So he's 28 at this point.
Right.
He's got that young, good-looking baby face that all the women loved, as opposed to being the veteran at 35 where everybody respected him. But already just an absolutely super athletic worker. And somehow, like he goes, how do you miss Ricky Steamboat? Especially because in the Carolinas, you know, I mean, he would get this enormous reaction. It's not like you're going in there and going like, well, he should be a star, but, you know, they're not really reacting that big to him. It's like, yeah, Flair was the one who, like, you know, pretty much put Steamboat on the map, and Steamboat was just on the map. And then Steamboat and Youngblood, they were the babyface tag team. And I mean, one of the best babyface tag teams I ever saw. But yeah, and you know, he would badmouth Hogan, he would badmouth Savage. I remember, you know, he did a show with me once, and he's bragging to me, like, oh, I fired Hulk Hogan and I fired Randy Savage. And it's like, I don't know that that's something you brag about. Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage became like two of the biggest stars. And he would go, you could go in any gym and find a guy and be Hulk Hogan. It's like, well, why didn't you do so?
But that, you know, I can understand with the changing of the guard being down on Hogan because he was for the kids and he was gassed up. But Savage, I mean, that's right up there with Steamboat as far as quality of worker.
Super worker. Well, they had a Thanksgiving tag team tournament in Atlanta one year when Ole was booking. And for whatever reason, Randy Savage and Magnum TA were brought in from out of the territory. You know, he must have heard about him, right? And I thought, this is great. Because Randy Savage I'd seen in Memphis and before in ICW. And he was so great. And I was like, they just announced him. Like, they didn't really build him up much, but he was going to be on the show. And I go, they're going to see that he's going to be on national TV and this guy's going to explode because he's great. Right. So he comes in for that tournament. I don't know what they did in the tournament, but I never saw him again. And it's like, how do you like not see Randy Savage? I mean, he was, he flew and he was dynamic and he was, I mean, granted, he didn't do the promos and everything, but still, Randy Savage was just the look and the way he carried himself. It was like, I just thought he's like easy to see.
What about, we did the same attitude about Pillman as well.
That was later. Yeah. I think he didn't like any of those young guys. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean? Young, pretty boys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, which again, that's kind of like when you bring it up like this, if you don't see Steamboat, who was better than Pillman and better than Zinc, what are you going to think of Pillman and Zinc? You know?
Yeah, right.
But he did go with Tommy Rich, which was interesting. But Tommy Rich was also, Jim Barnett was really, really high on Tommy Rich. And Tommy Rich did get over very, very big. So I guess, you know, he went with him.
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, when he was booking, like, you know, he didn't like the funny manager, Jim Cornette, the funny manager, Paul Heyman.
Right.
It was just not, you know, wrestling changed.
Yeah.
And that's the deal. You know, it changed and Ole was the same.
To start to wind down, let's talk about Ole's role in the formation of the Four Horsemen. Obviously, he was in the first iteration of probably the most famous faction in pro wrestling history in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, the Four Horsemen was just like a fluke. You know, one day they were on TBS. It ended a little early. You know, time management wasn't perfect. Dusty was booking. And it's like, we got 5 minutes to kill. Well, Flair, Arn and Ole were probably tag champs. Tully was U.S. champ. And Flair was probably world champ and JJ's with him. Hey, you guys, just go out there. It's like, you know, and that's all you need to do, right? Go out there. Hey, Ric Flair, Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, Ole, talk for 5 minutes, right?
Right.
So in the talk, Arn just goes, where are the Four Horsemen? Well, the next week on TV, there's all these, and they're all wearing their suits, right?
Yeah.
Flair and Tully were. I don't know if Arn and Ole were, but Flair and Tully were. And Flair was the most charismatic guy anyway. So they come back the next week and you got all these fans in the front row wearing suits, calling themselves the Four Horsemen, and they just kind of like went with it, and it became a thing. And Ole was never in his book, he almost like, I barely wrote about it. And when people would ask, I hated the Four Horsemen, you know, because for him it was Gene and Ole, that was the thing, you know, not the Four Horsemen. He just thought wrestling had changed, and you know, it was again, they're working for Crockett. He thought Jim Crockett was an idiot. He thought Dusty was an idiot. You know, he thought Ric Flair didn't know how to wrestle. So he wasn't really particularly happy. I don't remember him ever saying anything bad about Arn, but
right.
he was there for a while. And I mean, you know, he was a great promo and an important part of the original group. And then when they brought Luger in, he was to take Ole's spot, and Ole retired, but he did a quick babyface turn and feuded with the Horsemen for a little while before he left. And then a couple of years later, he came back again under WCW, and they did the reenactment of the Four Horsemen with Arn. And then that's with Sting, and they did the turn on Sting, and Ole was, you know, when it came to that segment where Ole kicked Sting out of the Four Horsemen, you couldn't have anyone better. I mean, that right. was the right guy in that segment to do that.
Talk about his theory. I don't even know where this fits in on the timeline, but his theory about, you know, most people are going to think that wrestling is real. And then found out differently.
Well, yeah. Well, that's my friend of mine is Jeff Buchanz, was always stockbroker, and he was a good friend of mine as well. He was his friend. So he's talking to Ole, and he had seen, you know, one of the newspapers in the Carolinas, and they did a thing on, you know, do you think pro wrestling is real? And it was 96% said no, 3% said they weren't sure, and 1% said, yes, we believe it's real.
Yeah.
And he goes to Ole, and he goes like, and I don't remember if it was Charlotte, Greensboro, Richmond, which is actually in Virginia. I think it was Charlotte, though, in that city, which was Ole's stopping grounds. You know, we're also talking 10 years past when Ole was there every week. And he goes like, what percentage of the people in, let's say Charlotte, what percentage of people in Charlotte do you think thinks wrestling is real? And he goes, Charlotte. He goes, 95% think it's real. So it was kind of like, oh, actually, you know, the newspaper did a thing and it's 1%. You know, in his mind, it was because they wrestled you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, the wrestling that they did in the 70s. And again, in the 70s, most of the wrestling was still entertainment oriented and they did
this stuff
and everything. But Ole did the thing where, you know, they did a lot of wrestling holds, a lot more than most people did, way more. And so Ole's belief was that because we do wrestling holds, you know, even though they're not it doesn't look anything like an amateur match or an MMA fight or a boxing match, but it was this style that they perceived to be realistic, that people believed that they were real. And he would always go like, Flair's out there doing all these flips into the corner. And
too many high spots.
Yeah. Steamboat's coming off the top rope. And it's like that stuff is, it's got a short shelf life, right? You know, it's like,
right,
it's not going to sustain, but we, the people week in and week out, they believe that we're real and they're going to come back to see us week after week because we make them believe it's real. That was Ole's mentality.
Ole had a son, Bryant Anderson. I think I might have seen him wrestle once or twice in WCW. He might have been gone by then, but I remember the guy, maybe Smoky Mountain, I saw him or something. What was the story with that?
He was in Smoky Mountain.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, because him getting into Smoky Mountain actually got Ole fired by Bischoff. You know, Bischoff, he was in there developmental. Well, you know, I don't think he had started with WCW because he's Ole's son, and he was a really good amateur wrestler.
Right.
And, you know, a good sized guy and everything. And he looked like Ole. And like when he talked just like Ole. I mean, he had Ole's voice. So Bischoff fired him, didn't see anything in him. So Ole talks to Cornette, who's running Smoky Mountain, and basically, you know, give my son a chance. And, you know, Cornette, you know, was a big fan of Ole growing up, obviously, like everyone was. And so he gave him a chance and everything like that. But I guess in doing so, you know, he brought Cornette in to talk. And Bischoff hated Cornette so much that he fired Ole for Cornette being on their grounds. You know what I mean? That's actually how Ole ended up being out of WCW. I mean, he'd been kind of exiled anyway when, you know, when Bischoff took over, he wasn't going to, you know, it's not like he was going to get another shot at Booker or anything like that, nor should he have.
There's a famous interview that you had with Ole when he put out his book, which was called Inside Out. How Corporate America Destroyed Professional Wrestling. Talk about that interview because it's famous and tell me kind of your memories and because Ole was kind of being a real jerk to you.
Oh my God. So, I mean, it's like, I try to forget that because it was actually probably the worst episode of a show I ever did.
The worst interview you've ever done out of thousands.
For sure. The worst interview I've ever done. Other than I interviewed some wrestlers that were like in their 70s and 80s that were senile by that point. I don't want to mention the names they were because they were great, great wrestlers in their day. And that type of stuff is such a horrible, horrible thing.
Right.
So they may have been worse in some ways, but there's like, and I can only think of one or two of them, but Ole's was definitely the most combative, but it was the worst. And it's like, he's on there to sell his book and he just starts picking a fight with me. And then the worst part was, is like, I freaking read that book from cover to cover just because I was so into that stuff. And so like everything he asked me, like, what do you think, you know, why would you do this? It's like, I knew every answer, which only made him madder. And then it's like, do you know why I fired Hogan? And it's like, yes, because he thought that he couldn't draw week in and week out. And even though he's drawing month in and month out everywhere else, this is why you didn't think he could work in Georgia. You know, he only was there for a short period of time and whatever. So, you know, I'd go through that and it just kind of like made him madder and madder that, and then he would do the thing about how, you know, like we would go out there and, you know, we would sell all these tickets and these guys, they just do merchandise. They can't sell tickets to the shows. You know, again, this is like WWF is doing great. I mean, it's like, they just are. They're doing great. Hulk Hogan's a big drawing card, giant. You know, he had this perception that people stopped going to wrestling because it was fake. And he had paid no attention to wrestling. It wasn't like, you know, I mean, he was just a guy who, you know, by this, he just paid no attention to it.
Did he have a lot of issues in that book with people that he had worked with, like, you know, like Vince or Dusty or like Heyman, those type of guys? Was that book airing a lot of dirty laundry and burying those guys?
Well, he definitely buried Vince. He definitely hated Vince, you know, because Vince bought the thing from him. And
sure,
I believe that there was a thing, you know, because you know how with Vince, it's like Ole must have told Linda to F off at one of these, because Linda was kind of like the lawyer, you know, with all this going on, and Vince brings her down and Ole's telling Vince to F off constantly, right?
Right.
And it is funny because I was actually kind of glancing through Ole's book this last week. And the one thing that I did think was interesting, though, is with the benefit of hindsight, he goes, I really blew it. He goes, I just should have gone up to work for him and made all kinds of money, which he would not have been a top star with Vince. He wasn't Vince's kind of guy then, but he still would have done reasonably well because he was a good talker and everything. But he never would go. And then, like, I think when he told Linda to F off, Vince was just like, you will never work for me again. You will never, you know, like, that's it. You know, you said that to my wife, right?
Right.
You know, there were two or three times where I don't think they actually invited him to be in the Hall of Fame when they inducted the Horsemen. I think it was already long gone. But there were one or two times where, for whatever reason, you know, maybe they wanted him to make a special appearance for something. Ole's line to Vince always was, is, remember what you told me? He goes, and I certainly don't want to make you look like a liar to your wife like that. And he never, you know, he never ever made an appearance in WWF, never would. I think it's kind of a sign that Vince is out of power, because they actually like lauded him on the show and talked
right.
to him. And I mean, there were bigger, much bigger stars than Ole that they never even would recognize.
Right.
So to me, it's kind of like Triple H is kind of like that thing of growing up with the Four Horsemen and everything like that. So Ole's a big deal as opposed to Vince, who like, hey, Ken Anderson, you know, I mean, if you remember Ken, Mr. Kennedy,
yeah,
when he went there, Vince made him change his name. I think it was actually Paul Heyman who picked Kennedy because it's Vince's middle name, and thinking like, if you're like Ken Kennedy, Vince is going to like probably like really like you. So it's a great idea. So, but the point is that he told him you cannot be Ken Anderson because he absolutely hated Ole Anderson that much.
It seems like Ole is kind of similar to Bill Watts, in that kind of just cantankerous guy who was all old school all the way until the business kind of passed him by.
Yeah, I think Bill was a lot smarter than Ole. Not that Ole wasn't smart. I never want to say that, because he was a smart guy.
Right.
Bill was a brilliant, brilliant promoter. Like, I would watch Bill's TV, and they were way more intriguing than anyone's TV. You know, just the way that they would lay out stuff for short term, for long term. But there's definitely similarities in the sense that they were both bullies. Bully their wrestlers. There is that. And Bill, you know, the unfortunate thing with Bill is Bill walked away from the business for 5 years and it changed. And when he came back, it was just like,
yeah,
like with you've been in the business for all these years, but you never walked away from it. Even when you were doing concerts and you were away for a long, long time, you were still following.
Yeah, of course.
You never had a period where you were just blank. It's not a part of my life. You know, Bill got out of wrestling, and it was just never watched the TV, never watched anything. 5 years later, he comes back, and like, I'm all celebrating, going like, finally, WCW's got somebody who knows how to book. Bill Watts, the best booker I've ever seen. And I remember like Bill called me up and had a 2-hour conversation with me. And right when it was over, I called up Pillman. I go, oh my God, you have no idea. It's like all of the guy, like Bill was still in that other era. And I didn't even realize it had changed that much, because, you know, you're living it every day and you don't really notice the changes. But when I'm thinking about like Jushin Liger, which is a perfect example, which of course Bill wasn't going to get. Jushin Liger, junior heavyweights, like, I just kind of like going like, this is kind of like an in thing now. You know, it's big in Japan. It's not really big in the United States, but it's going to be big in the United States. It's just for sure once people see these guys. And he just goes like, oh man, I'm a big believer in junior heavyweights. He goes like, I booked Danny Hodge on top. And it's like, you know, and Danny Hodge was not a high flyer. Danny Hodge was a wrestler. And it was just like, oh, you don't know what I mean. You know what I mean? It was like kind of like that. It's like, it's this thing. And then, you know, as you remember, you know, the first thing Bill does is ban coming off the top ropes in like 1992, when who wanted that wrestling?
Last few thoughts on Ole Anderson, because there definitely won't be anybody like him ever again in the business. And
no,
some reasons that's really, really good.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it's weird, because it's like, I just find it. And I mean, I guess I see it all the time, but it's like guys that are like, I mean, I know these guys, they're smart guys. Somehow like they just won't evolve. But Ole was like the perfect thing of one of those original guys like that, in the sense of, and even like with Barnett, you know, Barnett would always praise him. I mean, praise him for his years that he was good.
Right.
Barnett hated him, obviously, because, you know, he got him out of the company. And it may have been the right thing from the Ole standpoint, if the guy was overspending and the company was losing all the stockholders' money and everything. Many, many people were very, very negative on Ole, especially in the 90s, which is too bad, because, again, like, I can go back to 79 watching that Georgia wrestling and 10,000-12,000 people every Friday night, or not every Friday night, but the Omni shows. And 5,000 people at the city auditorium and everything. And it was a freaking hot place. I got to know one more story, you know, which is another person who hated Ole, which was, of course, Bobby Heenan. Do you know the Bobby Heenan story?
I don't. This should be a good way to end it off. Let me hear it.
Okay. You know, Bobby Heenan, of course, was usually Vern's guy, but they would do things where he would leave for a while, you know, because everybody left, you know, that's just how the business was. So Bobby Heenan's in Georgia, and he's with Blackjack Lanza and Killer Carl Cox and some other guys. You know, he's got the Heenan family down there, and they're doing great. Business is good. You know, he's talking to Ole, and Ole goes, you know, Bobby, you know, you should buy a house here. And he's like, I don't know, you know, I'll probably end up, you know, I'm going to run my course here and have to go somewhere else, you know, because that's how it was. He would go 6 months, yeah, a year, another place. It was Vern, it might be 2-3 years, but, you know, you're always moving around. So it's like, I don't know about buying a house. And he just goes, Bobby, I will never fire you. You know, you've got a job here for life. So Bobby goes and buys a house, and 2 months later, Ole fires him.
Ah, yes. The old school ways of pro wrestling, man.
Yeah.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks, man. It's always a pleasure to pick your brain about the history of the business. And once again, you'll never see a guy like Ole Anderson again. So this legend will live forever.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.